Jane knelt on the floor beside him. She could see that he preferred her at a distance. I'm curious about something.
You're a damn cat with all your curiosity.
Why did you name the house computer Annabelle?
What's that got to do with the price of beans? Go get the money you came for, honey.
Money, honey. Ryman Simon. Of all the names in the world, why name the house computer Annabelle? It's a simple question. Isn't that a simple question?
Nothing about you is simple, is it?
I didn't mean honey. It's just how I talk.
I'll go back to bitch, make us both happy.
Okay, all right.
The system doesn't come with a set name. You have to give it one. I could have called it anything.
But you called it Annabelle. Your mother's name is Annabelle. Does it make you feel special to be able to tell your mother what to do, and she always obeys? For the first time, he was nervous. In spite of his solipsism, perhaps he began to be troubled by the thought that even if he was the only real person in existence, even if the universe had been created solely as a vehicle for him to tell his story, his fate could take an unexpected turn for the worse. 47. Still kneeling beside Simon Yegg, Jane pressed one finger to the dimple in his chin. Just like that actor back in the day, Kirk Douglas. When you were little, did your mommy put her finger in your chin dimple and call you adorable? As he had said, he wasn't stupid. He knew where this must be going, and it was forbidden territory. His expression did not betray the anger that he wanted to conceal from her, but his eyes belied the impression of unconcern and self-control that he worked hard to project. Thus far, they had been as opaque as the eyes of a ventriloquist's dummy, but now they revealed an inhuman fury. If he had not been tied down, he would have killed Jane to prevent her from pursuing her current line of inquiry. She wiped her chin-probing finger on his rugby shirt. Tell me now, how much do you hate your mother?
You're off true north yourself. You're totally off the map. My mother's a great lady.
How much do you hate and fear your mother? She persisted.
Just shove it. Shut your mouth. You don't know her.
But I know about her. Four husbands, each an effete wuss, a trust fund baby from the day he was born. Each of them had just scads and scads of inherited wealth.
You don't go there. You don't go to family. Ever.
Four divorces? She gets everything she wants. More than she wants. They give her whatever it takes. They're in terror of her.
They all loved her, Simon insisted. Not a one of them ever said a word against her. Not one word. Not ever.
Flat on his back, he suddenly couldn't swallow his saliva as fast as it formed. He choked and coughed. Strings of spittle sputtered between his lips, spattered his chin. Jane watched this brief episode with interest, because it had meaning for her. The three pairs of salivary glands in the mouth secrete 3 pints of saliva every day. The purposes of saliva are to moisten food for swallowing, help keep teeth clean, convert complex starches into sugars, and minimize acidity in the mouth. The production of this fluid can be accelerated by the sight or smell of delicious food, also by nausea, among other things. Although it's frequently written that someone's mouth went dry with fear, it is more likely that extreme fear, which contributes to acidity in the mouth, will trigger a sudden flood of saliva, which is a balancing alkaline. Jane said, "In the years following those divorces, one of her husbands committed suicide. The note he left behind claimed he had come to hate himself for his cowardice and weakness, so he believed he needed to suffer. He made his death especially hard for himself by using a barbed wire noose. Another took a vacation to Jamaica, where his body was found hacked apart with a machete, pieces of it arranged in various elaborately drawn voodoo vaves in an old Quonset hut used for occult ceremonies. Another, your father, died during an evening at a friend's house when a home invasion robbery went bad. His friend was shot to death, and he himself was burned to death when the intruders, who were never caught, set the place ablaze to cover their crimes. You'd be amazed, Ryman Simon, at how much security her remaining ex has. Even though your dear mom is now 75 and he's 86, why, the President of the United States doesn't have that much security. Simon swallowed hard, licked his wet lips.
You're taking facts and making them into something they're not. It's all distortion.
If you don't hate and fear your mother, why did you tell your wives she was long dead? I know you told Dana because I talked to her, so I figure you told the other three the same. He sounded tubercular, words rising like bubbles through the saliva that slurried down his throat.
You get away from me. Stay away from me.
He turned his face from her.
I won't listen anymore.
Every one of your four wives was the image of your mother. Uncannily like her.
You're talking shit now. Crazy shit now.
All of them the same height and weight. All with raven black hair. All with blue eyes. Just like your mother in her youth. There, on the floor before the stage, the lightfall favored his supine performance as he turned his head toward her again, his face a mask of astonishment and abhorrence. Words eluded him as he worked his mouth in search of them. Sociopaths were good actors. Lacking all feelings other than self-love, they were nevertheless able to fake a panoply of emotions that in other people were real. This man wasn't half as accomplished a thespian as others Jane had known. However, his stifled speech and his nuanced expression of shock far exceeded the highest level of performance of which he'd previously shown himself capable. Although he surely knew that he was doing to wealthy women what Annabelle had done to wealthy men, Jane could believe that he might not have been consciously aware of choosing only mother figures to abuse and break and loot. Sociopaths were as efficient in the human ocean as sharks in their water world. They were humming engines of need, untroubled by any doubt about their rightness, and imbued with such a strong sense of superiority that they could not conceive that failure might be a possibility. They were empty vessels. Their minds were hollow spheres of certitude. Yet each of them believed he had more facets than a treasure of well-cut diamonds, and was certain he knew those countless aspects of himself in full detail, though all he, or she, knew was what he wanted and how to get it with ruthless action. Therefore, this first crack in Simon's armor, this rare moment of psychological insight that badly rattled his self-image, was an opportunity Jane must seize before he repaired it with the mortar of delusion. She pressed him. Petra's the same weight, height, body type as your mother, blue eyes, like your mother. She's a blonde, but there are times, aren't there, when she wears a wig for you? The wig was a guess. Petra had not mentioned it. Simon's eyes widened with further shock. His face twisted with hatred and alarm, his slack mouth spilled forth a thin drool, proving the truth of what she'd said. You can't be a man with it unless you hit them or break them or steal from them. All you can do with it is pee. Your hands are in your pants, and your fingers aren't numb, so why don't you feel for it? See what condition it's in, if you can even find it. He choked on excess saliva and coughed, and found the words that had eluded him, all of them obscene, vicious, a torrent of invective. Jane rose from beside him and sat on the stool once more. She gazed down at him, not with an expression of disgust, but with an indifference that would nettle him more. As if she had considered stepping on him, yes, but had decided that crushing him wasn't worth soiling her shoe. His curses dried up, and he lay in wordless passion of the darkest character. Theater light pooled in his baleful eyes, fading their color. Yet his gaze seemed to sharpen the longer he regarded her, as though in his helplessness he sought to tap the godlike power that every sociopath believed would one day manifest in himself, and behead her with his stare. "Two things," Jane reminded him. "The money is the least of them. The second thing I want is your brother, your half-brother, Booth Hendrickson." If Simon was surprised, he didn't show it, and he remained silent. Perhaps he understood that his fearlessness had been revealed as pretense, that he had been diminished in her eyes and would be further reduced in her estimation if, when speaking, he again became intemperate. Even though he was lying in bonds, he needed her to be afraid of him, not because he was formulating a plan to exploit her fear and turn the tables on her, but because he needed to believe that when he wanted to disquiet other people, he could alarm them enough to elicit their respect. Being an evoker of apprehension was a core part of a sociopath's self-image. She said, "Your brother's flying in from D.C. on an FBI jet he commandeered for his work at the Department of Justice. He'll land at Orange County Airport, the private plane terminal, at about 10:30 tomorrow morning. One of your company's limos will pick him up. Don't deny it. Researching you, I hacked your company. I saw the booking for him. So what I want is, you pull your scheduled chauffeur off the job, and I'll supply the driver." He said, "No." "No? You really think no is an option?"
"Time comes, I'm gonna put a hand up your snatch and rip your guts out through it."
"So you skipped high school biology, huh?" He sheathed his dagger eyes. "Anyway," she said, "your hands are still in your pants. Find any little thing yet? Maybe if you think about punching your mother in the face, that'll work better than Viagra." He hated her too much to keep his eyes closed. The sight of her filled him with homicidal fantasies, one of his favorite forms of entertainment. From the breast pocket of her sport coat, Jane removed a micro cassette recorder, smaller than a pack of cigarettes. "Everything we said is on this."
"Why do I give a shit? I'm telling you, I'm wired into so much protection the cops will shine my shoes if I ask."
"Maybe I know cops who don't shine shoes." "Cops or no cops, I'll hand a copy of this to your mom, in another recorder, ready to play. She lives under her maiden name, Annabelle Claridge, half the year on an estate in La Jolla, half on a waterfront estate in Lake Tahoe, Nevada. When I give it to her, I'll suggest if she gets a gift box on Mother's Day, she should call the bomb squad to open it." Throughout their tête-à-tête, Simon's complexion had been florid to one degree or another. Now, he paled. "I could leave you like you are for the weekend," Jane said, "and be in La Jolla in little more than an hour. Your mommy would be able to have a listen over and over again before you'd have a chance to explain yourself. Do you think you might get just a spanking? Or do you maybe wish you had presidential-level security like the one of her four husbands who's managed to stay alive?" He needed only a moment to consider the situation.
"What are you going to do to Booth?"
"Just ask him a few questions."
"If you do anything to him, the biggest damn hurt you can imagine is going to come down on you. I don't know his world, what he does in it, and I don't want to know. But he's in with the biggest movers and shakers, and they look out for their own."
"I'm trembling."
"Yeah, well, I'm serious. You're gonna be one sorry-ass bitch if you so much as muss his hair."
Jane got off the stool. As she explained how she expected him to assist her, she walked slowly twice around the mechanic's sled, studying him as if he were some bizarre sea beast that she had found on the beach. When Jane was finished with her explanation, Simon said,
"I need to piss."
"This theater," she said, "is the swankiest urinal in California." 48. In the garage, to the left of the workbench, stood a 16-foot-long bank of 7-foot-tall cabinets, a single built-in unit with 4 doors. Behind the first 3 doors were shelves stocked with parts and supplies for the repair and maintenance of Simon's car collection. Behind the 4th, an empty space, without shelves, offered only a pole near the top, from which coveralls and other garments might be hung, though nothing hung there now. Jane stepped in front of the open door adjacent to the empty unit. In her right hand, she held a plastic thumb-size electronic key, blind-stamped with the word HID, the initials of the company that had provided it. She'd found the key in Simon's desk, just where he had promised it would be. Holding it at arm's length, she pointed it at the cornice rail of the cabinet above the open door and moved it left to right until a single beep signified that a code reader had approved the key. A series of concealed lock bolts clacked open, and the side walls of the cabinet whisked pneumatically out of the way, to the left, taking with them the loaded shelves, which now filled the previously empty 4th unit, as if they had always been there. When Jane stepped into the now empty 3rd space, her weight triggered a lock release, and the back wall of the cabinet, inch-thick steel clad in wood, whisked to the right, revealing a walk-in safe about 14 feet from front to back and 20 feet from side to side. Overhead lights brightened automatically as she entered the vault. 3 walls were lined with 2-foot-deep shelves, and in the center of the space stood an 8-foot-square work island with a stainless steel top. Some of the shelves were unused, but others held cardboard file boxes, guns, ammunition, cartons containing she knew not what, and the 2 high-end 4-inch-deep titanium alloy attaché cases stored where Simon had said they would be. She put the cases on the work island and opened them using the combination locks. Each contained banded $10,000 stacks of $100 bills, each bundle vacuum-packed in waterproof plastic using a food-saver sealing appliance. In weeks past, she'd invaded a few homes of the self-described Arcadians and always found cash, on average, $200,000 per residence. Usually there were forged passports as well, in a variety of names, and credit cards to match. Considering that they were people of extreme arrogance who saw themselves as the rightful makers and rulers of a brave new world in which they could murder those whom they deemed bad influences on the culture and enslave hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of others with nanomachine brain implants, Jane found it telling that they all took the precaution of squirreling away the cash and credentials to support a hasty exit from the country, to get them to wherever they had secreted fortunes to sustain them in the aftermath of failure. Under the egoism that armored them, beneath the layers of pride and conceit and disdain, at the center of the rotten fruit that was their hateful conviction, nestled a seed of doubt. Simon Yegg apparently wasn't one of the Arcadians. He didn't resort to noble talk about saving civilization as a justification for using people. He just ruthlessly used them. Maybe intuition warned him that the consequences of his actions required that he be prepared to flee the authorities in some crisis. Or maybe his half-brother had hinted at possible ugly consequences of the work in which he was involved. For whatever reason, Simon had stashed passports and other forged ID in each attaché, and he'd set aside more get-out-of-dodge cash than any Arcadian. $480,000, half in each titanium case. 49. With Sanjay Shukla strapped in it, Carter Jurgen turns the dinette chair off its side and tips it up onto 4 feet once more. He spends the next 2 hours alternately using his laptop to scout possible Caribbean vacations and studying the young writer who sits in wet-eyed silence when he isn't weeping. The tears seem excessive, but perhaps a successful writer must be more sensitive than make sense to a non-writer. Growing bored with the Caribbean, Jurgen opens himself to a more exotic getaway in the South Pacific, and begins to investigate Tahiti. At last, Bradley DeBose returns with Tanuja. After what must have been a vigorous workout, the big man ought to appear sated, a little loose in the joints, his eyes heavy-lidded, his face softer in the afterglow of such a release. But DuBose looks as edgy as ever and remains darkly energized. Still the West Virginia golem that he has always been, as if shaped from mud, invoked with life by some ill-advised ceremony and sent forth on a mission of revenge. The girl seems weary, but not broken. Her hair is in disarray, one sleeve ripped off her t-shirt, the collar torn along the stitch line. When leading her to a seat at the table, DuBose jerks too hard on her leash. In a furious silence, she pivots to him and strikes his massive chest with her fists, tries for his face, but fails to land a blow there. He grabs her by the neck, jams her in the chair, and ties her leash to the stretcher bar. For his part, DuBose is amused by Tanuja's rebellion. He seldom either laughs or smiles, and now his amusement is conveyed to Jurgen only by raised eyebrows and a shake of the head. He leans against the counter by the sink and fishes the half-finished hand-rolled cigarette from his jacket pocket. He preps the joint and fires it and takes a deep drag, staring into space, as he did before the idea of doing the girl began to be irresistible. Now that Tanuja is seated within the candlelight, Jurgen sees that her lower lip is swollen, blood coagulated in one split corner. When she speaks to her brother, however, her speech is not thick from the injury. Softly and with grave tenderness, she says, "Sanjay? Chotti bai?" He cannot look at her. He sits with his head bowed, and when she says chotti bai, whatever that means, his weeping, which has recently been quiet, becomes a wretched sobbing. "Chotti bai," she repeats. "It's all right." "No," Sanjay says. "Oh, God, no." "Look at me. You have no blame," she says. When he can't bear to face her, she says what sounds like, "Peripona." This so affects Sanjay that he gasps and looks up at her and says, "Benji, no, I don't deserve your respect or anyone's." "Peripona," she insists. Curious, Jurgen says, "What does that mean, peripona?" The girl turns her head to stare at him, and though she is shackled to the chair, the ferocity in her eyes and the loathing in her voice chill Jurgen when she says, "Go fuck yourself, you disgusting pig!" This elicits a small laugh from DuBose, and though the chill lingers in Jurgen's bones, he smiles and nods and says, "Indulge yourself in a little rebellion." He consults his wristwatch. "You don't have much more time for it." 50. Earlier, leaving Simon Yegg firmly bound at the foot of the stage, Jane had rolled Petra Quist out of the theater and into the lobby once more. Although the girl had not wet herself, she no longer professed an urgent need to pee. She hadn't been voluble and challenging as before, but reserved, taciturn, and sober. Now Jane returned with a black-and-yellow four-wheeled Rimowa suitcase that she had taken the liberty of packing, with a couple changes of clothes and what she thought were the essential items from Petra's share of the master bathroom drawers. She stood it by the candy counter. She also brought a pair of sneakers, socks, jeans, a sweater, a leather jacket, and Petra's purse, all of which she put in the half-bath adjacent to the lobby, so that the girl could dress in more practical gear for what might lie ahead. Jane brought as well one of the titanium attaché cases that contained $240,000. She placed it on the upholstered bench in front of the office chair to which Petra remained shackled. She would keep the second case. The quest for truth upon which she had embarked was also a kind of war, and wars were expensive. She sat on the bench beside that treasure, In the short and sleeveless dress, Petra still appeared to be all long legs and slender arms, but she did not, as before, evoke thoughts of fashion models and party girls. Her powerful sexuality, bestowed so generously on her by nature, which she so diligently maintained and enhanced, had for the moment ebbed. Time seemed to have carried her backward through its forward flow, washing from her all iniquitous experience and corruption, so that she had become a gangling, awkward child. She sat with head half bowed, eyes open, but perhaps seeing some memory of another time and place. A bluish bruise shadowed the line of her jaw on the right side of her face and half her chin, no doubt a result of the blow she'd taken from Jane's forearm when she'd been jammed against the refrigerator in the kitchen. "Some people," Jane said, "will tell you Simon is a vicious swine, a woman-hater, a sleazy thief, a self-absorbed narcissist, and they're half right. He's all those things, but he's something worse." Petra said nothing. "He's one of those dangerous people that we call sociopaths. He fakes being human, because he lacks all the emotions you and I feel. He cares only about himself, and if he felt he could get away with it, he would commit any atrocity you can imagine, without remorse." There seemed to be no anger in this girl, no bitterness arising from how dismissively Simon had spoken of her. Rather, she appeared to be shaken by the realization of how naive she had been. Perhaps she thought it not possible to imagine a way forward. Events had unmoored her. She must feel adrift. "Some believe sociopaths are born that way," Jane said, "and others believe they're made that way by dreadful parenting, nature or nurture. I think it's both. Some are born that way and some are made. In Simon's case, I suspect he was born sociopathic, the son of a sociopathic mother, and then made worse by her. Now he knows you told me stuff about him that he didn't want known. If I turn him loose after this thing with his brother is done, and if you're still where he can find you, he will kill you, Petra, and he will make it a very hard death." After a silence, the girl met Jane's eyes. "Do you think it's true? What he said about Felicity and Chandra and them?"
"Felicity and Chandra who?"
"My crew. You know, my girlfriends. He said if I go missing, like, in a month, they won't remember my name. That's shit for sure, don't you think?"
Jane considered her words carefully. "Remember your name? Of course they will. Miss the free limo? Yes. And I bet you buy a lot more drinks for them than they buy for you, so they'll miss that. But care that you're gone? What do you think?"
Petra broke eye contact, glanced at the door to the theater.
"Sweetie," Jane said, "it's not that you aren't memorable. God knows you'd be hard to forget. But tell me true, if one of them dropped out of your crew and just went away, would you care?"
The girl opened her mouth to respond, frowned, said nothing. "A life of superficial pleasures can be exciting, a lot of fun, even thrilling, for a while. But if you party every day, they soon aren't parties anymore. They're desperation. And if all you do with your friends is party, then your friends are really strangers."
Petra closed her eyes and hung her head, perhaps thinking about what might have been, what had been, and to what end her 26 years now pointed. She whispered,
"Where do I go from here?"
"I don't know. And no one can tell you where. You've got to find the way yourself. But this may help."
The sound of the latches opening on the attaché case raised Petra's head and opened her eyes. "It's nearly $250,000, Jane said. Regarding the cash with a solemnity that defied interpretation, the girl at last said, "What if all that money undoes me?"
"Simon's not going to report it stolen."
"No. I mean, what if I take it and slide back into all the usual shit? Not with Simon, but with some other guy."
"If you can ask that question, then you probably won't slide."
"No guarantee, though."
"Life doesn't come with one."
Jane closed the case. From her tote bag, she removed a pair of scissors. She cut the zip tie binding the captive's right wrist to the arm of the chair.
"I'm not your enemy. Never was. Now that you're not drunk, I'm counting on you to remember that."
She gave the scissors to Petra. "Just the same, I'll move back a ways while you free yourself. Use the half bath to freshen up and change clothes. I'll wait." As the girl cut the plastic strap on her left wrist and then leaned forward to feel under the chair for the ties that bound her ankles, she said, "That stuff about their mother made me half sick, you know? I feel dirty if I was like her to him. Is the brother that twisted?"
"You don't want to know about the brother," Jane said. Getting up from the chair, putting the scissors on the bench beside the attaché case, Petra appeared unsteady, muscles cramped.
"I guess I don't want to know your name either."
"You've got that right."
51. In the church kitchen, the silence of grief and the stillness of dread, the brother's guilt and the sister's forgiveness no longer spoken but palpable. Two of the three dwindling candles guttering in their glasses, flames twisting and leaping as if to take flight from their wicks and morph into butterflies, lambent light and rippling shadows tattooing ever-changing patterns across the faces of the twins, faces as spectral as any appearing in a séance. As if he is the last judgment embodied in a dark and fierce form, Radley DuBose comes to the table and speaks to Carter Jurgen.
"It might have happened by now. Let's try the trigger and be done with them if we can."
Those adjusted persons injected with previous iterations of the command mechanism have been accessed and controlled by the phrase, "Play Manchurian with me," a reference to the famous 1959 novel by Richard Condon, a thriller about brainwashing. That was a little joke of Dr. Berthold Schenck's, the recently deceased genius behind this application of nanotechnology. Jane Hawke has learned that unlocking sentence. Therefore, all the adjusted people thus controlled are being reprogrammed as quickly as possible. For new conversions, a fresh set of triggering words is installed with the latest generation of the command mechanism. From across the table, Jurgen regards the twins and says,
"Uncle Ira is not Uncle Ira."
He doesn't know who chose these new keywords. The sentences from Invasion of the Body Snatchers by Jack Finney, a 1955 novel, twice filmed well, about an alien life form that perfectly mimics specific people, takes their place, and disposes of them. The analogy is not as apt as is the reference to the Condon novel, but not every Arcadian is as keen of wit as the late Dr. Schenck. Sanjay responds a fraction of a second before Tanuja, but both say, "Yes, all right," which is the correct programmed response. The brain implant has self-assembled, and the twins now possess only the illusion of free will.
"Lovely," says Jurgen,
pleased that after the long pursuit and so much inconvenience, the conversion of the Shuklas into adjusted people has ended well. Brother and sister appear to be as alert as ever, but they are in a kind of trance, where they will remain until Jurgen or DuBose releases them with the words "Auf Wiedersehen," which in German mean "until we meet again." Jurgen says,
"You must do precisely as you're told. Do you understand?"
The twins reply, "Yes," in unison. DuBose releases them from their collars and leashes. As instructed by Carter Jurgen, the Shuklas wash the dishes and glassware they used for their dinner and put everything away. They neither speak to each other nor exchange a glance, as efficient as two ants operating according to genetically prescribed roles.
We're going to drive you home now, Jurgen tells them.
All right, they reply. One of the candles gutters out. Jurgen extinguishes the other two, and the Shuklas carry the warm glasses out of the building, so that nothing too unusual will be found in the morning, thus focusing the attention of the police largely on the rectory, where Reverend Gordon M. Gordon's material body lies in the absence of his soul. 52. Dressed more demurely in jeans and a sweater, Petra Quist was once more graceful, her brief regression to childlike awkwardness behind her. She wheeled the Ramoa bag with her right hand and carried the attaché case in her left, preceding Jane into the garage and to the Cadillac Escalade, the least attention-getting vehicle in Simon's collection. She loaded the suitcase through the tailgate but put the money on the front passenger seat. "Use the Cadillac only for a few hours," Jane advised, "until you're where you can rent a car. You should be safe then. I'll make sure Simon doesn't even think about looking for you. His brother and the people the brother's involved with, they don't have a reason to be interested in Simon's ex-girlfriend. They're no threat to you." Petra regarded Jane for a long moment. Her expression, that of someone puzzling over the meaning of a line spoken in a foreign language. "I tried to slash you with a broken bottle." "You were drunk." "But I would have. I more than paid you back." "How's your jaw?" Petra touched the bruise with her fingertips. "Not too bad. But the thing is, like, I don't know how to say thank you." Jane smiled. "Yes, you do. Don't backslide. Find a new way. Be truly happy. If I were you, I'd stay away from the glamorous places, the glamorous businesses you've been in. That's not life. It's only an imitation of life. Find a place that's real, some town that looks like it came out of a 50s sitcom, with people who might even be who they seem to be. Never before in my whole life did anyone do something for me without wanting something bigger in return." As Petra walked around to the driver's door and opened it, Jane followed. "You don't mean never in your life." "I do. I mean it. And it's true." Hearing a trace of melancholy in the girl's voice, Jane found it necessary to say, "None of my business, but do you know when it all started going bad for you?" "Oh, yeah. Yeah. I know the year. I know the day. The hour. A long, long time ago." "Maybe it's good that you know. If it was a mystery, if it was forgotten, well, you can't exorcise a demon if you don't know its name. And even then, maybe you can't exorcise it. Maybe you can't. But you don't know till you try." Petra nodded. She started to speak, stopped herself. Then, in a voice thick with emotion that she was clearly intent on repressing, she said, "Nice shoes." "They're nothing special, just Rockport Walkers." "Yeah, I know. But they're tough. They last. They do the job." Jane said, "All you can ask of a shoe." Looking up from the Rockports, Petra said, "I'll never forget this. This. Right now." "Neither will I," Jane said. Petra got in the Escalade and closed the door and started the engine. Using a remote control, she raised the segmented roll-up. With the engine noise racketing off the low concrete ceiling and the walls, Jane watched the Cadillac cruise out into the night. 53. In a trance state, the twins are told by Radley DuBose to sleep until they are awakened by their names. They sit in the back seat of the Range Rover in their safety harnesses, eyes closed. Her head is tipped slightly to the right. His chin rests on his chest. Although they must be exhausted after such a long and stressful night, Theirs is a most unnatural sleep, commanded upon them, and perhaps their dreams, if any, are of a kind that no one but adjusted people can experience. Jurgen drives east, out of the more populated cities of West County, toward the rural hills and canyons in the east, taking the Shuklas home. Their Hyundai Santa Fe Sport, which they had abandoned at the burned-out ruins of Honeydale Stables, had earlier been returned to the garage at their house. A crew had removed every trace of the events in their kitchen, including the liberal splashes of hornet-killing insecticide that the girl had used to free her brother from Lincoln Crossley and the others. Soon, the twins will begin the final chapter of their lives, a murderous frenzy that will make big news and imprint their names on the public mind as the names of monsters. Tanuja's recent novel, which is not a bestseller yet but has generated buzz and has the potential, according to the Hamlet List program, to shape an entire generation's moral perspective, will be forever anathema, despised and unread. Jurgen glances at Dubose.
You mind telling me something? She was good. Lubricious, you would say at Harvard.
I assumed she was good.
So why ask?
Why not wait for her control mechanism to be
operative? Spare me the phony New England gentility.
I don't know what you mean.
Son of a Boston Brahmin, so refined that he's mystified by the crude behavior of the backwoods boy.
Once she was adjusted, she would have obeyed your every command. You could have avoided the struggle. Dubose turns and tilts his bearish head and regards Jurgen from under a ledge of brow, his expression so rich with sarcasm that no words are necessary to convey his meaning.
So I guess I'm to infer, says Jurgen, that the struggle made it better for you. There you go. Well, I don't know. You never had it that way? Don't bullshit me.
Never, says Jurgen. I like things easy.
But the way she is now, it'd be like doing it with a robot.
A very attractive robot.
Then when we get them back to their place, go for it.
No offense, Radley, but not just after you've been in there. This elicits from Dubose a rare laugh, low and sour.
Isn't it a little weird to be so fastidious after everything we did tonight?
Well, just the same. I'll pass. Anyway, we only did our job.
Dubose says, making the world a better place.
54. Jane Hawke had slept late Friday morning and taken a nap in the afternoon in preparation for all that she'd done in the past 12 hours. By 4:30 Saturday morning, after saying goodbye to Petra Quist, she wanted a few hours' sleep to be ready for Booth Hendrickson when he arrived in Orange County from Washington 6 hours hence. But she was wound tight, not in the least drowsy. Simon Yegg, with no hope of freeing himself, marinated in his own juices in the theater. She had no need to watch over him. In the kitchen, cautious of the shattered glass, she found another bottle of Belvedere, Coca-Cola, and an ice maker full of cubes in the shape of half moons. She built a drink and carried it into the study, where she turned on the desk lamp. Near the lamp stood an iPod. She considered reviewing its playlist, but music might mask other sounds that she needed to hear. She was an accomplished pianist, as had been her murdered mother, and as her mother-murdering father still was. Just recently, he'd toured to the acclaim of adoring fans when, if the truth were known, he ought to have been rotting in prison for the past 19 years. To Jane, music had always been nearly as essential as food, listening to it and bringing it forth from a Steinway. She might have tried to make a career of recordings and concerts, except that a grand piano, with its lid raised by the prop stick, too often reminded her of an open coffin. Her mother's coffin. An association not conducive to a performance of concert hall quality. She didn't need analysis or Freudian jargon to understand why she had chosen instead a career in law enforcement. As she sipped the vodka and coke, she withdrew half of a broken cameo locket from a pocket of her jeans. A woman's face in profile, carved from soapstone, embedded in a silver oval. Her lovely little boy, Travis, founded on the water-washed stones beside the creek behind the house where he was being secretly sheltered by friends. Travis had convinced himself that the woman on the locket was the very image of his mother. To him, it was an omen of her ultimate triumph and return to him, but also a talisman that would protect her from all harm as long as she carried it. To Jane, this piece of a locket with half a hinge attached was enchanted and precious, not because she believed that it had magical powers, but because it had been given to her by her child, Nick's son, who had been conceived in love and brought into the world with the hope he would find in it the wonder, the joy, and the truth of things that make a life worth living. When she held the locket and closed her eyes, she could see Travis as clearly as if he were in the room with her, the shy little boy who shared the precise shade of his father's blue eyes, with tousled hair, a sweet smile, and the intelligence that sometimes made him seem like a little man waiting patiently to be done with childhood. Maybe it was the vodka, or maybe the locket that soon settled a calm on her. When she finished the drink, she returned the cameo to her pocket and set the alarm feature on her wristwatch. She rose from the desk and turned off the lamp and stretched out on the sofa. She asked that her dreams, if any, be bright visions of her child. But for a girl who had, at the age of 9, discovered her mother's bloody corpse in a bathtub, and almost 19 years later found her husband in a similar condition, dreams were more often dark than bright. 55. More than 40,000 feet above the surface of the earth, with the sun behind the plane, a distant and receding darkness in the west beyond the curve of the planet, the reassuring drone of two powerful Rolls-Royce turbofan engines, almost 90,000 pounds of craft and fuel cruising well in excess of 500 miles per hour, a grand defiance of gravity. The scrabbling multitudes of humanity toiled far below, feverish in their often pointless and nearly always misguided strivings, unaware of the change fast coming to their world. This is a thrilling time to be alive, especially if you are Booth Hendrickson, the lone passenger in a Gulfstream V configured to carry 14 in addition to crew. He finds it rewarding to be known by the grandees of Washington and their grubbing minions, not merely as an attorney highly placed in the Department of Justice, but also as a go-to man who can arrange discreet off-the-record meetings between highly placed officials in any of the security services and law enforcement agencies, and with selected other poobahs in the maze of bureaucracies. It is even more satisfying to be within the inner circle of the techno-Arcadians, of whom 98% of those grandees, minions, and poobahs are ignorant, his power, in fact, far greater than they know. Not a little of the satisfaction comes from the perks that he is able to bestow upon himself, such as this splendid aircraft. The Gulfstream is owned by the FBI and, as specified in the original appropriations bill, is intended especially to facilitate urgent investigations involving acts of terrorism. Such is Hendrickson's authority that he needs merely to claim, without supporting details or documentation, that his business is both urgent and related to uncovering some nefarious scheme involving white supremacists or Islamic radicals, and the jet is his. He has just received a late breakfast, prepared and served by the steward, a crab omelet made with duck eggs, a serving of sliced potatoes deep-fried in coconut oil, buttery baby carrots al dente and flavored with thyme, brioche toast. The food is delicious, but the wine disquiets him. When making flight arrangements the previous afternoon, He'd specified far niente Chardonnay for breakfast. He has served instead a Pinot Grigio of only moderate distinction, and it is a shade too sweet to accompany the omelette. Although the steward is apologetic, he has no explanation for how this could have happened. There is no Chardonnay aboard, and Hendrickson must make do with the Pinot Grigio. Instead of the two glasses that he might have allowed himself, he drinks only one. He is not a superstitious man. He does not have any regard for portents of calamity, for omens foretelling either good or evil. He doesn't accept the existence of gods or fate or luck. He believes only in himself, in the efficacy of raw power, and in the plastic nature of a material world that can be bent to a strong man's will. Nevertheless, as he finishes breakfast with mandarin orange slices under shavings of dark chocolate, the disquiet inspired by the wine only grows. He listens to the Rolls-Royce engines for any change in pitch that might suggest some mechanical problem in its early stages. After the meal, when he tries to work on his laptop, he can't resist consulting a variety of sources for weather reports in expectation of turbulence ahead. Hour by hour, all the way across the country, although he repeatedly counsels himself that this apprehension is groundless, he can banish it only temporarily. He finds himself repeatedly reviewing news stories about the recent bizarre death of a billionaire who was a founder of the Arcadians. He revisits digitally archived evidence of Jane Hawk's presence at the site in San Francisco where the death of that man occurred, in spite of heavy security. Because this is evidence that he has studied previously, and from which he can't possibly gain new insights, he must admit that this bitch of bitches has gotten under his skin. When Hendrickson arrives in California, as he disembarks from the jet at the private craft terminal at the Orange County Airport and sees his limousine and driver waiting on the tarmac, which his status allows, his apprehension swells into alarm. His half-brother, Simon, seems to have sent him a subtle message that all is not what it appears to be. In fact, it is so subtle that no one else would recognize it as a warning. A shrewdly conceived and softly rung alarm only brothers might hear. And perhaps only brothers who had survived a mother like theirs and been bonded by the experience. Suddenly, the situation requires vigilance, tactical elegance, and cunning. Hendrickson acknowledges some fear, but he is also electrified by the possibility that Jane Hawk has made a grave mistake. If someone is trying to get at him through Simon, it is surely Jane Hawk, because she recently became aware that Hendrickson is a techno-Arcadian, one of the most effective spears of the revolution. If he plays this right, if he stays calm, stays cool, he may be the one to kill her. Part 2. Migraine Jane. 1. At 8:45 that Saturday morning, Gilberto Mendez, former Marine, mortician, about to be chauffeur impersonator, had parked his Chevy Suburban in a quiet residential neighborhood under a lacy pepper tree beaded with tiny pink corns where he could be sure there were no traffic cameras. He wore well-polished black shoes, a black suit, a crisp white shirt, a black tie, and a double-peaked black cap with a short bill. The pants were of a suit purchased a month previously, but the matching coat was from 2 years earlier, when he had been 40 pounds above his ideal weight instead of just 20. The extra room in the coat allowed for the concealment of the shoulder rig and the Heckler & Koch 45 compact that Jane had given him. Setting out on foot for a public park 5 blocks away, he thought that he looked somewhat out of place, though none of the people he encountered, sweating runners, smiling dog walkers, kids on skateboards, gave him a second look. The sky was the very blue of the birthing blanket that his wife, Carmela, had purchased in anticipation of their fourth child, whom she now carried into her third trimester. The rain of the previous night had washed a brighter green into the trees, more dazzling colors into the flowers, and the lawns were almost as unreal as artificial turf. This was a wonderful day to be alive, which was a thought that perhaps occurred to a mortician more often than to people in other lines of work. In a certain Middle East hellhole, he had known a day when a devout chaplain questioned the value of it, or even the value of all days that time had thus far dealt out or ever would. Gilberto was not as devout as that good man, yet there were moments in even the most terrible hours when he saw the beauty of the world that the worst of humanity's actions couldn't obscure. An enchanting pattern of purple shadow and soft light on the stone floor of an ancient courtyard, a white bird in flight against a golden dawn. And such moments assured him there would be days when all darkness, not just that of night, would remain at bay. Although he carried a firearm into this bright morning, it was a wonderful day to be alive, in part because he would again fulfill that sacred warrior's pledge, Semper Fi, made not just to country, but also to freedom and to comrades in arms. The park contained a playing field on which a group of young girls were already darting through a game of soccer. Majestic old oaks, crowned like a conclave of kings, shaded tables and benches on a picnic ground. In a parking lot, by a lake, shimmering as if it were a pool of mercury, the white Cadillac stood where Jane had promised he would find it. With whatever explanation, the owner of the limo company had ordered an employee to leave it there. The vehicle wasn't locked. After putting on a pair of driving gloves to ensure he would leave no fingerprints, Gilberto opened the door, lifted the floor mat, and found an electronic key taped there. When he settled behind the wheel, he hesitated to close the door, ostensibly because a newly sprung breeze stirred the jasmine espaliered across the wall of a nearby park maintenance building and carried its fragrance to be savored. In truth, he delayed because it seemed that when he closed the door, he might be shutting himself off from his future, from his wife and daughters, from the unborn son he might never see. The scent of jasmine, however, was the olfactory equivalent of a white bird in flight against a golden dawn. He said, "Semper Fi," and closed the door and started the engine. 2. At 8:30 that morning, Jane Hawk had been awakened by the alarm function of her wristwatch. She got off the sofa and went to the window in Simon Yegg's study. She stood for a while in the early light, which elsewhere fell on her child and on the grave of her husband, and to her it was the light of a love that conjoined them, regardless of distance and time, in life and death. She felt no need for further sleep, nor any weariness. In the bathroom connected to the study, she washed her face and adjusted her raven-haired wig. She removed her colored contacts and floated them in solution in their carrying case, and with the end of that eclipse, her eyes were bluer than oceans when she met them in the mirror. She went downstairs to the theater, where Simon lay bound and reeking of urine, as if emptying his bladder had stimulated his liver to produce a flood of bile. His face swelled with rage, both pale and florid, like the mottled scales of some exotic serpent. His bloodshot eyes welled with such festered and virulent malignity that they could not have appeared more alien if they'd had the vertical irises of a snake's eyes. At the sound of her approach, he spewed bitter curses and threats. When she stepped into view, Simon strained mightily against the restraints that had foiled him all night, rattling the wheeled board under him. As she stood over him, watching, he seethed at her, told her what parts of her anatomy he would cut off while she still lived, and into which of her orifices he would cram what he butchered from her. Strangely, his ordeal had only strengthened his sociopathic certainty that he was the axis around which the universe turned, that he couldn't die, because his death would be not just the end of him, but the end of all, The suffering that he currently endured was perhaps, to his way of thinking, some test of fortitude prescribed by the unknown masters of the game of life, and he would pass it and triumph and break her as she could never hope to break him. His fury seemed demonic, and therefore inexhaustible, and it burned undiminished when he recognized